I'm Kevin Kelly. The show is Live and Local. It's your connection to local music and more. And on the program today, a little music, a little theater, beginning with the theatrical portion. Love Song is a play by John Kolvenbach, and it is under production by the Celebration Company at the Station Theater in downtown Urbana. They opened last week and will continue for the next 2 weeks, all shows at 8 o'clock. And with us are Kay Bohannon-Holly, who is the director of the show, and also two of the four actors involved. Then in the middle portion of the show, oboist Nancy Ambrose King, who was formerly of the University of Illinois School of Music faculty. She now teaches at the University of Michigan, but she's coming back to give a guest recital and masterclass tomorrow in the early afternoon. We'll talk with her and hear just a bit of her playing. And then in the last portion of the show, Central Illinois Children's Chorus is giving its 32nd annual winter concert this Saturday in Champaign, and we'll have two of their directors with us on the program. A full house here today on Live and Local. Hope you'll stay tuned. And if you happen to have been listening to this program on Monday, you might have recognized the distinctive sound of that harp. It was a Celtic harp played by Patrick Ball, who was my guest on Live and Local on Monday's program, and he performed in Urbana Monday night. That was from his disc called Music on the Wind. And the tune, The Foggy Dew, which is a traditional melody, which he played rather distinctively, and heard here on Live and Local. I am Kevin Kelly. This is WYL FM and HD Urbana, and on this portion of the show, we have two of the actors and the director for the production of John Kolvenbach's Love Song, which is being presented by the Celebration Company at the Station Theater on North Broadway in Urbana. They opened last weekend, and I got to see the show on Saturday, I think it was. And it's going to be running through the 19th. They do take a few days off each week, but just about every day between now and then, 8 o'clock shows each evening. And for information, you can go to stationtheater.com. Cable Hannon Holly is, in fact, the director. And the there is no title character, but if there were a title character, it would be the character of Bean. And he is played by Matthew Green, who is with us, and also Katie Baldwin, in the role of, I just forgot your character's name, Katie.
Molly,
that's right. And so I thank you all for coming in today. What, I was looking up, trying to find information on John Kolvenbach, and I didn't find a whole lot. The Wikipedia entry was distressingly short, and I found a number of other reviews and short bios, which were also really quite short. And a little information on Love Song, which I had the impression is maybe his best-known play so far. Is that
true? I think so. Would you say that? I think Matthew probably knows most about him.
Yeah. And I don't know a great deal.
Everything you know.
I know very little about the playwright himself. What I do know is mostly about this play. I've been interested in this play for a while. Gary Ambler and I were talking about it. I want to say at the end of last season, I think he suggested that I read it, and then I realized I actually already owned a copy. And in reading the play, it became very obvious to me that this would be a really, really good show for the station, both in terms of our space and our talent pool and just the kind of stories that we like to tell. And at the time, we hadn't discussed, you know, where it might fit or, you know, who might be interested in directing it or whatever. I just told him that whoever wound up doing it, I was going to audition for the role of Bean as many times as I had to.
Or
and
else,
right? And I made him
right?
audition about 15 times.
Yeah. Yeah, and it took that many to get it right. Huh? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you actually raised a question in your description there, Matthew, which is, what makes a good show for the Station Theater, which for those who haven't been there, is in fact a very small space. It's a remarkably flexible space given that consideration. And there isn't a fixed company of members, but there are certain actors who do show up there with some regularity.
We do have a company. That's what we're referring to when we talk about the Celebration Company. But it is very fluid. Mm-hmm. People come and go in and out of it. And there's a sort of a core of people who are involved over and over and over again. And, of course, we're always hoping that new people will come in and audition for us or volunteer to work on shows. But what makes a good station show? It's interesting to try to answer that question because the typical kind of show that I think people mean when they say that, if you look back over our history, we've sure done a lot of shows that did not fit that description. Mm. Big musicals, you know, huge casts. We've tried just about everything over the course of the years. But I think what people mean when they say a show is perfect for the station is that it is something that can be accommodated in the space that we have and fully realized in the space that we have, where we don't feel like we would have to skimp or tighten or reduce or whatever to do the show. Also for us, it's always been about the artistic quality and the vision of the show, the storytelling that goes on in the show. We like to choose plays that are not only entertaining, but challenging and take on topics and themes and whatnot that not all theaters, I don't think, are willing to deal with. I don't know. Can you add to that?
It's interesting. It's interesting that you use the word challenging, because I thought that goes for the audience and for the actors and producers and directors. Mm-hmm. We do tend to challenge our audiences to stretch their imagination or stretch the concept of love or of friendship or of marriage or, you know, any number of ideas. And I do think that that's one of my favorite parts about this company is we challenge our audience to stretch emotionally and mentally, I think.
Mm-hmm. One of the reviews of this show talked about the fact that our season is a very ambitious season, which
is nothing unusual.
No, it's certainly not, but it made me feel really good to read that it was
acknowledged.
It was acknowledged. It was picked up on and commented on that we're pushing. We're trying to push our own creativity. We're trying to push our own abilities. We want to strive to do shows that otherwise, sometimes even shows that we don't even know if we can pull off.
Mm-hmm.
It's you know, we do a lot of shows, we dive in thinking, this might not be possible, but we're going to go down swinging. And more often than not, we come up with it because we have an amazing creative group.
We don't hit a home run every time, you know, but it's our standards of quality that we hold ourselves to are very high. We may not always get there, but we do sort of feel like we can withstand a sort of a noble experiment gone wrong, or, you know, a high ambition that maybe didn't end up being realized, much more than than we're interested in doing shows that just aren't very good. You know, and we've had some noble experiments that kind of went wrong, and occasionally, you know, we have done our share of My Fair Lady or, you know, those kinds of shows, more commercial shows. But I think we've balanced it over the 38 seasons with a lot of theater that might not have been seen in our community.
Well, I'm trying to remember of the shows that I have seen the station do, and I'm afraid it's much spottier than I wish that it were. I think the ones that have attracted me anyway were, in fact, the ones that were not likely to have been done by anybody else in the area.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so that, for me as an audience member, has certainly been a great appeal. I mean, would I go to the station theater to see My Fair Lady? I don't know. Probably not, you know, because there's one of those things where you do have to make compromises, because suddenly you have to reduce a whole orchestra to maybe three or four players. And I actually heard that worked rather well.
It did.
If I remember.
but
I wasn't in the audience. Well, this particular play, Love Song, I'm aware that it's difficult to talk about, because you can only, if you're describing the story, you can only go so far into it.
Right.
Because, you know, as with, you know, various
stuff
plays, stuff happens, and there's things that then hinge on whatever the things are that happen. So in other words, we can't give away certain aspects of it. But what can you say about Love Song that might, that Matthew, for example, you said this was a play you really wanted to do for some reason.
Very much so.
And if you wouldn't mind, just back away from the microphone just a little bit so we don't explode it. Thank you very
much. Oh, okay, sure. Sorry. I'm a leaner.
Yeah.
This was a show that appealed to me, self-centeredly from an actor standpoint. This was a character I really wanted to try.
And what? So who is Bean?
Bean is a very closed-off, very isolated character who has, I would say he has, how can I put this and make it vague enough? He has a certain condition which prohibits him from interacting too much with the world. And then he has some self-imposed limits as well. He's mistrustful of the world, and because of that, he's made himself a very sort of Spartan existence. He's not someone who interacts. He's not someone who is looking to explore too much. But he does have a sister who loves him, and who tries in her way to look out for him. That would be Joan, played by Joy Hoffsummer. And he has, by extension, because Joan is married to a sort of lovely man named Harry, played by Gary Ambler, he has a sort of a brother who is intrigued by Bean, doesn't always know quite what to do with him. But so he has a very limited, he has very limited contact with the outside world. But he meets someone in the only way he ever possibly could, and that's because someone has intruded upon his life. Mm. And that's how we meet Molly.
And that's Molly, played by Katie Baldwin.
Literally, she's an intruder.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He has no choice but to meet her.
Yes.
What is one of your lines? You have a few lines about your particularly, potentially malicious character that I now can't remember.
Gosh, I have lots.
She says, no one has reviled. No one welcomes someone as reviled as I am.
I've caused hemorrhages and hematomas. I've broken bones with a glance. Lots of really.
I am force without reckoning.
I am force without conscience.
There you go.
I'm the stuff of fiction. I mean, I had lots of anxiety the first time reading that. Once I got the role, I read it and thought, how in the world am I going to sell that? How?
Yeah, you don't. I mean, you're sitting here. You don't
believe that.
You don't come across, you know, visually as somebody who would be that.
I'm a tiny little woman. And I thought it will happen eventually somehow. But first day reading, I thought, how am I going to sell that? And I like to think that I have and that I can. But that was really, there's a lot of statements that Molly makes that are pretty gutsy.
Well, I think that one of the wonderful things about Molly is that she wants to believe those things about herself.
Yeah.
That she is, you know, hideous and dangerous and heartless and
to be feared.
And to be feared. Mm-hmm. And
despised.
And Bean, little old Bean with his isolation and lack of experience somehow sees through it.
Mm-hmm. It's like he doesn't know any better. Yeah. He doesn't know that he's supposed to hate her and fear her.
Well, in a way, you know, I imagine it depends very much who's playing that role. But at least you played the role, and that's what I saw. And from an audience point of view, you know, it seemed like all of those things. You could be fooling yourself. You could be fooling him. Or the part of the scary part could be that you looked so innocent, but you really could be capable of these things, which made it all the more latent and therefore to be feared, you know. Mm-hmm.
That's good to hear, because I wonder how it comes across sometimes.
Yeah.
Because I do layer in all three of those aspects, that I am tricking myself, I am tricking the world, and in some levels, at some points in the show, I do actually believe those things about myself, as Molly, mm-hmm. that those are true things. And I think upon meeting Bean, Molly starts to question the validity of her fearsomeness and her hardness and toughness.
Mm-hmm. Well, the part I think we can say is that you seem to make Bean happy somehow or another. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, somehow. Some way or another.
And vice versa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's. I know you brought a couple of short scenes, and you had to be very selective because of what we've described. You know, you can only tell so much. Mm-hmm. And also because there are language issues in this play.
As there are in most contemporary realistic plays.
So you had to sort of excerpt. So would you like to, somebody want to set up the first one you're going to do?
I've asked them if they would do a little bit from the scene in which they meet when the intruder shows up at Bean's apartment. This is starting with Molly's question.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you a question? What kind of life is this?
I think that's two questions.
Look at this. A cup, a hat, a hideously... Look at this thing. It is the hair shirt of hats. Who would wear this? Gloves, half a tube of toothpaste, a toothbrush, a razor, three pairs of identical socks, the underwear, which ordinarily I'm not out here liberating briefs, but it's slim pickings, and a spoon. A single spoon. Can you explain this to me?
It's a spoon.
You don't have a fork.
I use the spoon.
You don't have a plate.
I use the cup.
You eat out of a cup?
Sometimes.
Who are you?
I was just hoping to ask you that
same... Where's the calendar?
My calendar?
or a painting, anything, a picture.
I guess there does seem to be a lack.
Do you have any relatives?
I have a sister.
Do you like her?
In what way?
In like there might be a picture. What's your name? What's your name, damn it? Do not make me ask you again.
Bean.
There might be a picture, Bean. A sign that you live here. That you exist on this planet. You might have acquired a plate.
I have the cup.
Are you a monk?
No.
A musician?
I work for the city.
A rich person. This I've seen. And then there's an offshore account somewhere bulging, but the guy lives on leftover crumbs and dust.
I don't have any money.
Who are you?
I'm not sure how to answer that.
Where's your closet full of sentimental collections?
I don't have one.
Why not?
I don't collect anything.
You don't not only not collect anything.
I don't have anything.
This is what I'm saying.
I figure I can just as easily eat out of a cup.
That is not how people are.
Oh.
People go to Europe. They're 20. They're in love. They steal, I don't know, an ashtray from a cafe. And 15 years later, it's ugly, but I was in love. And in Paris, you keep the ashtray.
I don't smoke.
That's not the point.
I guess I don't collect.
I'm not sure you exist.
What kind of criminal did you say you were again?
A diary.
I've never kept one.
A pen.
I don't like pens.
Everyone likes pens.
And thus they meet cute.
Meet cute.
This is an inside-out romantic comedy.
Yeah, no kidding. You know, what is the deal, though, with that line, are you a monk? Are you a musician? What is the problem with musicians here?
Don't take it personally.
I'm not, yeah, I'll try not to.
Yeah, knowing plenty of theater people and musicians, I can say that many of them do have possessions that could fit in one paper bag.
Well, you know,
because of the lives
true.
they choose to love and live, they have this is what they own is in one bag, and that's all they need.
And that's kind of the case of Bean,
mm-hmm. yeah.
To
yeah.
say the very least.
Yeah,
the very
yeah.
very least.
He has what he needs, and he doesn't know that he should possibly need anything else. He gets by with the few things he has, and he doesn't really have any interest in expanding his world beyond that.
And the progress from that point is essentially the progress of the play.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But not just for you, but also for your sister and, mm-hmm. and her husband.
Yeah, that's one of the things I love about the play is the parallel arc that exists with Bean and with his sister, Joan. There's a lot of parallelism in this play. It seems like every time I talk about it, I discover another one. But certainly with Bean and Joan, you know, come to find out that Bean, who has not perhaps done it as consciously, has narrowed his life down to a very tiny little isolated space and a path that I think he wears out over and over and over again, doing the same things. And it turns out that Joan has closed her life down in some real important ways as well. And during the course of the play, we get to see both of them travel from that place to something new, in my opinion.
I would venture to say that the third relationship that really develops is between Bean and Joan. I really think that they had a very rhythmic and methodical kind of brother-sister relationship, and once this sort of new person in their lives comes to light, I think their relationship changes drastically. I mean, mm-hmm. It's not just the two romantic stories. It's this sibling relationship that really flourishes.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, obviously, theater takes situations and heightens them for dramatic emphasis or whatever. But, I mean, it's very interesting. I have a younger sister who is now an adult. And it's very interesting to sort of get to know somebody you've known all your life all over again as a grown-up. And to realize things about them. And it's interesting how relationships change. I think there's the obvious dramatic emphasis on the discovery of love in this play and how that changes people and how that changes their interactions with and their relationship to other people. But there's also that very basic everyday understanding of this is how I look at you. And now I know something new about you. And that changes how I look at you, and it maybe changes the way I look at myself. And it's one of the really beautiful things about this play. I think it's a very hopeful play. And it's, you know, any play that's about discovery, any play that's about learning something new is not only rare, but it's a kind of a joy to work with.
Well, in a way, you just kind of put your finger on what maybe the typical play for the station is, at least the ones I've seen, where there's all the ones I've seen, there's some element of that. Whether it's outrageously comic or darkly tragic or whatever you call, however you would characterize this particular play, and the audience learns something and the characters learn something. And you can, because the space is so intimate and because there's usually not a large number of actors involved, again, at least the ones I've seen, you are that much closer to the characters physically that you can see them relate to each other. You can see them develop. You can see all their little ticks and foibles. And Matthew, in your role, I imagine one of the challenges was physical, in sort of trying to portray whatever the unnamed condition or conditions that Bean has.
And the condition is unnamed on every level. It's not named in the play.
Right.
And we haven't even ourselves really pinpointed an exact condition. Yeah. Although we've certainly honed in on a range, but I decided it wasn't, insofar as the playwright chose not to define it. It wasn't really our job to overly specify that whatever it is that's going on with Bean. But it had to be clear. You know, Matthew had to make some clear choices physically and otherwise.
Did you have to do any medical consulting to?
We did a bit of research, both in physical manifestations of different conditions, we'll say, and vocal, certain very specific patterns of speech that were common, again, to certain conditions. I didn't want to narrow it down too much because then suddenly you have something that is readily identifiable and something that people are going to start nitpicking, which as an actor is dangerous, because you want to be true to the character. And the character is a creation. It's not flesh and blood until it's on the stage. But also that I didn't want to be so broad with it that it became this casserole of symptoms. And, you know, suddenly
what
it's just...
Did you call it the other day? Psycho stew? What was it?
You call it psychosomatic stew. You called it casserole. He's called it a grab bag.
I've heard you describe food metaphors. Yeah, I
called
just
a best of greatest hits.
A greatest hits.
I've heard you could describe it many different ways.
I'm very wary of that because obviously you don't want it to be in any way off-putting, but at the same time, this is a character that requires a certain amount of concentration to be played truthfully, and I mean before I had finished the play, I made up my mind I wanted to play this guy. My only question was if I could.
Well, I think I said to you afterwards, you certainly had what had to have been a physically and emotionally draining and mentally draining role.
Yeah.
But you did remarkably well. There's obviously depth to this thing. We could go on for the rest of the hour. We can't. So I'm going to say thanks at this point. We're talking with Kay Bohannon-Hawley, who's director of Love Song by John Kolvenbach, and two of the four actors in the production, Matthew Green as Bean and Katie Baldwin as Molly, and it's running through December the 19th for reservations. The station is located in downtown Urbana, by the way. For reservations, call area 217-384-4000. And for more information, stationtheater.com. And I thank you all very much for coming to Live and Local today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, oboist Nancy Ambrose King for a brief chat and a little bit of her playing in a moment. And then a couple of the directors from the Central Illinois Children's Chorus giving their winter concert on Saturday. Our program today is supported in part by the Danville Symphony Orchestra presenting Voices of Christmas this Saturday at 7:30 p.m. at the Danville High School Auditorium. It's a program of Christmas favorites for the whole family. More information is available at 443-5300. Thank you. Oboist Nancy Ambrose King with pianist Eric Dahlheim, a showpiece from the three-piece suite for oboe and piano by 20th century composer Madeline Dring. Nancy King will be on the University of Illinois campus in Urbana tomorrow to give a short recital at 1 o'clock and then a master class at 2 o'clock. She's formerly of the University of Illinois faculty, currently on faculty at the School of Music at University of Michigan. And here on Live and Local, I had a conversation with her yesterday, and here's a brief portion of that. I asked her, what are some of the challenges about teaching the oboe?
There's a lot that's challenging about playing the oboe. So I think that probably the most challenging part of teaching the oboe is figuring out what is going wrong with a student and their ability to produce the sound that they want or to produce the technical fluidity that they're striving for. And, it's sort of similar to being a good doctor, I would think. You take a lot of symptoms and you try and figure out based on the symptoms that you're hearing and that you're seeing in their embouchure and that they're describing of the difficulties they're having, and you try and take all those symptoms and first figure out a diagnosis and then figure out a way to correct the problem.
So what are some of those challenges as a player about playing the oboe?
Well, I think that the oboe is very similar to the human voice in that it, you know, the pitch really can be all over. I mean, it's not an instrument that is inherently ever in tune. And, of course, we're making a reed to play virtually every day. We play a different reed. And even if we're playing the same reed we played the day before, a reed that was sharp yesterday could be flat today. A reed that was too easy to blow yesterday could be too hard to blow today. So pretty much every day we have a new instrument to play on and a new instrument to adapt to.
For somebody who doesn't know about an oboe reed, see what you can do about sort of bringing it down to earth. What is an oboe reed like and why is it so finicky?
Well, the oboe reed is really the voice of the oboe. And it is it's a double reed, meaning that it's two pieces of cane that are tied together and they vibrate against each other. And every oboist makes a reed to suit not only their taste in sound quality, but to play at a certain pitch level based on the ensemble that they're playing in. In European orchestras, they play at a higher pitch than they do in the U.S., so you make a different reed. So it determines the pitch, it determines the tone color, it determines really everything about what it takes to play the oboe. It is the instrument much more than the piece of wood and silver keys that you see oboe players holding.
So during lessons, I don't know if it's the typical lesson, but I have heard that oboe players spend a lot of time learning from their teachers not only how to play the instrument, but also how to make the reeds.
Definitely, yeah. Reed making is a huge part of being an oboe teacher and an oboe student. What I like to tell my students is that you can be the world's greatest musician and the world's greatest oboe player, but if you can't make a reed, the world will never know what a beautiful player you are and what a great musician you are. If you are a great reed maker and you consistently make a reed that responds, that plays in tune, and has a pleasing sound, well, you'll go very far in our profession because the conductor will point at you and you'll blow and there's going to be a nice sound that's in tune and it speaks when the conductor points his baton at the oboe player. So, yeah, it is a huge part and it does have a role in every oboe lesson.
But some oboists do buy their reeds from people who are particularly noted as reed makers, don't they?
Not so much anymore. In the old days, that was very typical. Some of our greatest oboists, back in Toscanini's time, even in the early Cleveland Orchestra with Zell, those oboe players would typically rely on their students, ironically, to make reeds for them. And unfortunately, for us oboe teachers, that's really not the case anymore. Everyone has to make their own oboe reads, and you know, obviously students buy their reeds, but I see the trend is exactly the opposite. I see students are making their reeds sooner rather than later, and I see some students at the age of 12, 13 years old starting to make oboe reeds.
So in a very literal way, oboists craft their own sound.
That's a very good way to put it, exactly. And I heard a great quote from Joe Robinson once. He said, the reed that, it is our instrument, it's our voice, and our voice could be Kathleen Battle one day and Ethel Merman the next.
And who is Joe Robinson?
Joe Robinson was the former principal oboist of the New York Philharmonic and a wonderful player and person.
Well, I hit a couple of buttons I didn't mean to there, but including shortening slightly the interview I had with Nancy King yesterday, running out of time on the program today. And I'll put up the whole interview in case listeners would like to hear the rest of it on our website, which will be at will.illinois.edu. This is Live and Local, and Nancy King is giving a recital tomorrow at 1 o'clock at the Memorial Room in Smith Music Hall on the University of Illinois campus in Urbana. That will be followed immediately at 2 o'clock by a masterclass that she will give with students here. And she assured me she will not be showing people how to make reeds, but the conversation about may turn to reed making at some point or another. And sounds like an interesting short recital, including some jazz-based pieces on that program, and both are free. That's in the Urbana tomorrow at 1 o'clock with Nancy Ambrose King, formerly of the University of Illinois faculty, now at the University of Michigan. Coming up next, a conversation about the Central Illinois Children's Chorus and their 32nd annual winter concert in Champaign this Saturday. Central Illinois Children's Chorus Chamber Choir under the direction, under the direction of Andrea Solia, the accompanist Michael Hammer, and that from their 2007 spring concert program at Smith Music Hall in Urbana. And Andrea is with us on Live and Local now, along with Charmian Bully, who is the longtime artistic director of the Central Illinois Children's Chorus. They're giving their 32nd winter concert this Saturday at 4 o'clock at Faith United Methodist Church on South Prospect Avenue in Champaign. All four of the choirs will be performing on that program. And so it should be lots of variety and lots of kids involved. So thank you both for coming in to talk to us today.
Thanks for having us.
Charmian, I know you said radio is not your thing, but I'm really glad to have the chance to talk to you here. I don't think I've talked with you on the air before.
No, you haven't.
Just many times.
Not for a long time.
Yeah, well, neither of our memories, apparently. You've been with the group for how long now?
Probably 25 years. The group was founded by Carolyn Paulin. She was their music director and founded the group with 19 children. And 32 years ago, they did that first concert. Ironically, it's where we're having our concert this year and where we rent space at Faith United Methodist Church, but it was in the old sanctuary of that building.
Which doesn't exist anymore, which, I gather.
Well, it exists, but it's not used.
That's the South, what is now the South
building. It's now called the South Sanctuary. But she started there with 19 children.
And there are how many involved in the program now?
Well, we probably have around 75. I'm not sure what the actual number is.
But a lot more than 19.
Yes.
And you've had sort of a progress yourself with the group from, you know, being the sole conductor, I guess, when you first started. And then did you add choruses over the time that you've had it?
Actually, just this past year, we added the youth chorale. Carolyn had asked me to start a group for very young children, as I would sit and wait for my own daughter who sang with the group. And so I did that, and that's kind of how I got started with CICC, was starting with the young children because I was in the music education business. And then eventually became the artistic director when everybody left town, and Carolyn left, and Dr. Melanie Williams was also the artistic director for 1 year.
So they left you holding the bag.
Is that it? With the group, and it's been a wonderful joy.
When you say you were in the music education business, that basically means you were a teacher.
I was.
For a long time. Bottenfield School for that whole time?
No. I taught in Unit 4 for 34 years.
And that's been now, how long ago since you retired?
Oh, probably 5 years.
Is that all? See, I was going to guess it was longer because I usually guess much shorter than things actually are. So, but that makes sense to me. And you did, until recently, I thought, conduct the concert choir as well as this youngest group that you talk about, the Music Makers.
Right. But Anne-Marie Morissette is now conducting the concert choir.
And how did you discover her?
Well, she happens to be a daughter of mine, but Andrea is the one who actually discovered her.
Oh, I think that's only partially true. What did you discover about Anne-Marie that thought it would be important to get her involved?
First of all, she's a singer, so she is she's a very good musician. She's been in town, she lives here, and she's also a music teacher, which connection we lost with the fact that when Mrs. Bully retired, we didn't have any connections with schools, so it was harder to get kids involved in CICC. So I thought we need to find the perfect music teacher who is an excellent musician and loves singing, loves choral music, and would be willing to take over one of our choirs. And that's how we found Anne.
Is that the largest choir, the concert choir, or not?
Actually, I think our chamber is probably
maybe
the largest.
Is it? Okay.
And we consider our chamber choir and our premier performing group, Andrea conducts.
Well, we've kind of alluded to all of them. Why don't you take us through the progress of the four choirs and how one moves from one to another, if that's in fact how you envision it happening?
Well, our Music Makers would be our youngest group.
What age
and
does
actually
one have to
I
be?
Have a couple 5-year-olds in that group.
Really?
We take children at 5, and I may have a second grader in there, and I have 20 children. They're wonderful, wonderful singers. So you start that musicianship early, and then we just move them into concert choir when we think they're ready. Concert choir might run from 2nd through 5th grade. And sometimes we'll have 4th and 5th graders in chamber choir that have been with us over the years. and, you know, we've built them that we feel that they're ready. They do audition to get into chamber choir with that conductor.
That conductor being Andrea.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have to audition to get into the Music Makers?
Yes, but it's a very simple audition, just matching pitch. I do games with them, and we just ask that they match pitch.
So if you can talk, you can probably be in the Music Makers.
Probably so.
Because when I used to work with kids, it's been quite a while now. Well, even when I was a whole lot younger, I became fairly convinced that there's virtually no such thing as somebody who has a true monotone. Everybody can learn to sing, whether they think they can or not. And I remember having, there was this kid when I was a kid who everybody thought that was true of, that he was monotone here and there. And at some point, he locked in, and that wasn't the case anymore.
It's sometimes finding that head voice. I do siren sounds with children that are having difficulty, and you play games with their voice, and all of a sudden they realize, oh, that's what I'm supposed to do.
So during the course of a concert, we shortchanged you here. So the chamber choir is the auditioned, and the auditioned group, I mean the real auditioned group, and as you said, the premier performing organization. And then you started the youth chorale. Was that just this year, you said?
Actually, it was last year.
Last year, we started last year.
What is that about?
This is about the boys who had changed, whose voices changed, and just bringing back to them to the organization, having the opportunity for them to sing again quality literature. So it's an SATB ensemble.
Soprano, alto, tenor, bass.
Soprano, alto, tenor, bass, yes.
The girls who are in there, do some of them also are
in chamber choir. We set an age limit, actually, in chamber choir, which the rule is that if you are 16 or turning to 16 during the academic year, you can sing in youth chorale without singing in chamber choir. I didn't want to, and I don't want to, and I'm not going to sacrifice chamber choir's level or artistic, talent by having the girls moving to youth chorale, which is very appealing to them.
Sure. Yeah, you don't want to weaken one group in order to create another one.
Exactly.
Well, that sounds like a good policy.
But we had a lot of 16-year-olds,
girls,
who did not want to quit, and they wanted to stay with the group, and that was also a motivating factor.
Is that okay, too?
Informing
Absolutely.
That. Yes, it is.
Absolutely. We had, in fact, one girl who is a senior right now in high school who was singing with us until she was 17 in both choirs. She's 18 right now, and she's only in youth chorale, but up until last year.
So she likes to sing.
She loves to sing. Very talented.
Actually, the age 16 was started years ago by Carolyn because a lot of the competitions or choral organizations that you might visit internationally, they had a limit on children called children's choirs at 16. I kind of hate telling a 16-year-old they can't sing, so it's this youth chorale is wonderful. They do.
They are very dedicated. They love what they are doing.
Well, there's probably something to be said, too, for some 16-year-olds who don't want to be called children at 16 anymore.
That's true.
Even though, the basketball coach at the U of I still calls his team kids, I notice. And the same thing with the football team, which is sort of odd. And, they're in college. Let's play another sample of the chorus. This, again, is the chamber choir under the direction of Andrea Solia from the 2007 Spring Concert Program. This is a piece by Renee Clausen, who was actually, we interviewed for this program a few weeks ago when he was visiting the chorale in Champaign. And this is his Psalm 100, features Carol Salo on flute and Sam Schmetterer on the marimba. Central Illinois Children's Chorus giving its winter concert on Saturday, and you're hearing this on Live and Local on FM 90.9.
Thank you.
Central Illinois Children's Chorus Chamber Choir demonstrating their prowess in music by Renee Clausen, Psalm 100, Carol Salo, one of the parents, actually, of kids in the chorus, playing the flute. Sam Schmetterer was marimba. Uncredited was Ariana Veloki, or Annie Veloki, on bassoon, and the director, Andrea Solia, from their 2007 spring concert program. Their 2009 winter concert is this Saturday at 4 o'clock at Faith United Methodist Church in Champaign. And all four of the choirs will be performing, the Music Makers, the Concert Choir, the Chamber Choir, and the Youth Chorale. Again, that's at 4 o'clock. And Charmian Bully, who is artistic director of the organization, is with us. Andrea Solia, also with us. And Charmian, you reminded me that you're also doing something at the Virginia Theater on Friday night.
Yes, we will be performing with the Tons of Fun Band at the Virginia for their Christmas show, Friday night at 7:30.
Are you actually playing with the band?
Actually, we're doing some selections on our own, and then, yes, we are performing at the end with the band. That's the concert choir. Our youth chorale is also a part of that evening.
Well, that should be fun because the Tons of Fun Band is, well, it's a fun band, as
yes.
you would expect from
yes.
the name, and not the average group that you would expect a children's choir to be singing with.
True, but we'll have a fun time doing that with them. This is a benefit concert for developmental services, and so it's a joy for us to be a part of doing that for our community.
Well, we're glad you could come in the program today. And I know we talked on rather short notice about maybe trying to get some members of the Youth Chorale on the show. So maybe in advance of an upcoming concert, your spring concert, we can work ahead at that and
sure.
see if that might be possible, because we'd love
it's
to
It's hard
the
to get them
in.
Out
Oh, I know.
During finals time.
Yeah. I'm sure they wouldn't mind at all, but there's this issue of academics, isn't there?
Yes.
They are very conscientious.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. Well, you know, there's an awful lot of people kids who are involved in music who are remarkably talented in academic ways as well. They often go hand in hand. Well, thanks for joining us in the program. I hope you have a great concert on Saturday.
Thank you.
And best luck of luck to all the kids and their parents who might be listening to this program. And we will have this up on the website probably later this afternoon. It's will.illinois.edu. This is Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly. Here's a few other performances you can go see and hear. Tonight, the University of Illinois Symphony Orchestra is performing at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana. That is at 7:30. Tomorrow, there's a preview for Saturday's concert by the Danville Symphony Orchestra and Chorus, Voices of Christmas. They're going to be in the Mills Breast Cancer Institute music series. That's at noon tomorrow, an hour-long free program in Urbana on University Avenue. The Champaign-Urbana Symphony Holiday Concert is tomorrow night at 7:30, also in Urbana at the Krannert Center. Solstice is a celebration of dance in all its forms at Millikan University, a rather eclectic choreographed concert with performances by faculty and students at the Albert Taylor Theater at Millikan in Decatur at 7:30 on Thursday evening. And we've mentioned Nancy King's guest artist recital at 1 o'clock on Thursday at Smith Memorial Hall in the Memorial Room upstairs at the University of Illinois, and then a master class at 2 o'clock. Big Bad Voodoo Daddy is a swing band giving a concert called How Big Can You Get? 100 Years of Cab Calloway. That's going to be Friday night at 7:30 in Bloomington at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. And at the Little Theater on the Square in Sullivan, it's Nuncrackers, the Nonsense Christmas Musical, twice on Friday at 2 and 8 o'clock, and then through the weekend as well. And A Christmas Carol is at the Parkland College Theater Friday through the weekend, performances at 7 o'clock and more. And this is Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly on the program. Tomorrow, some members of Desafinado, the Latin band, are going to be performing live with us. And also, who was my other guest? Yes, the Vintage Brass Band from Springfield. We'll be hearing about that concert as well. This is Live and Local on WYL FM and HD Urbana, operating translators W293 AF Danville and W266 AF Urbana. It's 20 degrees at 101. From